You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, September 14th, 2017. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, senior editor from the Washington Monthly, former policy director and managing editor of New America's Open Markets Program, Philip Longman, will be here to tell us why it's time to fight healthcare monopolies. The day after Medicare for All is introduced with 17 co-sponsors in the U.S. Senate. Also on the program today, deal or no deal on DACA. And McConnell may nuke blue slips, paving the way for the most conservative judges we've seen in a generation, or the moon falling into Lake Michigan. Meanwhile, Mueller chasing social media and the Flynns are in deep doo-doo. Trump's new ethics heads okays anonymous gifts to legal defense funds. Not so coincidentally. And Moochin Mnuchin in some hot water of his own over his honeymoon ask.
Okay.
Oh, man. Michael's away. Matt will play. Pharma boy Martin Shkreli. Shkreli? How do I say his name?
I think it's Shkreli.
Jailed even before he's been sentenced to jail. And rest in peace, Grant Hart from Husker Du. One of my favorite bands back in the day. All this and more on today's Majority Report, ladies and gentlemen. So overnight, apparently late last night, Donald Trump met with Nancy and Chuck, and they hung out, and I guess they basically just said, I don't know, people will like you more if you support DACA, some type of legislative fix for the executive policy that you rescinded. And he must have said, really? Do you really think they'll like me more? And Chuck and Nancy said, sure, yeah, of course. And he said, well,
think of how big the propaganda file can get after.
Wow,
like
okay.
That.
And then, but what about the wall? Because the wall is really important. It's not important to do. It's important to talk about, like I said to the Mexican president. And they said, well, let's do that separately. And we'll just promise more border security. Big border security? Yeah, big border security. Okay, deal. And here he is announcing it this morning after coming off of a helicopter ride. And just listen to this guy.
The wall will come later. We're right now renovating large sections of wall, massive sections, making it brand new. We're doing a lot of renovation. We're building four different samples of the wall to see which one we're going to choose. And the wall is going to be built.
I mean, it's just amazing. First of all, the guy's lying, right? But aside from that, like, we're building four samples of walls. We're going to see which one we like best. What goes with the drapes, which goes with the couch, which goes with the picture. He has to say this. I mean, because we know this from the transcripts of his conversation with the Mexican president. he knows how important the wall is to those guys wearing baseball caps in that stadium in West Virginia, or that, you know, that auditorium in West Virginia. So he's got to pretend he's just lying. And
he's appealing to consumerism too with that. Like, we need to figure out, like it's a showroom,
right,
of
exactly.
different walls.
Totally. We're not sure if we're going to go with the stalactite pool or just like the bluestone.
It's beautiful,
or
terracotta.
I mean, a terracotta. We're not sure. So we're going to see all four. We'll see which one we like the best. So here he is. He's talking about the wall, and then he goes, keep playing.
And the wall is going to be built. It'll be funded a little bit later. Well, we want to get massive border security. And I think that both Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, I think they agree with it. But so we met last night with, as you know, Schumer, Pelosi, and a whole group. And I think we're fairly close, but we have to get massive border security. Oh, I think he's on board. Yeah, Mitch is on board. Paul Ryan's on board. We all feel, look, 92% of the people agree on DACA. But what we want is we want very, very powerful border security, okay?
I think 92% is just a made-up number that he pulled out of.
I feel like we would have known that.
I sort of feel like 92% is... That figure is the equivalent of the figure that I, at the end of the show, when I talk about where our members' revenue comes from, I just pull out a number that's like, it sounds like right, but I have no idea. I've never done the work. And I sort of feel like that's what he's doing for this major piece of legislation that he apparently has decided Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell are on board with, which maybe they are.
They are now.
Paul Ryan, I think yesterday, had said something to the effect of, like, we should have a DACA. And so if all goes well, there'll be massive, huge border funding, whatever that means.
You could just call it the Big League Border Security Act and, and just send, like, a few National Guard troops down.
Exactly. Actually, what's going to happen now is, we're just going to spray paint all of their trucks gold. And hopefully this will end up with a DREAM Act, which will go even further than DACA and provide some more permanence. Now, this could fall apart by the time you're listening to this program. If you listen on podcast, it may have fallen apart in just the time that it took for us to play this video. But what it's going to do, in the worst case scenario, is rip apart the Republican Party in many respects. In the best case scenario, it's going to get a DREAM Act passed and rip apart the Republican Party. We obviously need to see the details, because I don't like the idea of having to demonize other immigrants, undocumented or not, to help these dreamers. The reality is, though, from a pragmatic, practical standpoint, we have bad cards to play in this situation. And so hopefully this will work out well. We'll talk more about the conservative response in the fun half of the program. But first, have you inherited an old coin collection? Or maybe you're like me. You have an accumulation of coins and currency that you're not sure what to do with. I've got to find those books. I keep saying that over and over again. Littleton Coin is here to help. For over 70 years, Littleton Coin has been helping people just like you sell their coins and currency. And as an industry leader in collectible coins and currency, Littleton can pay you more. The best part, because it's really all about being able to trust the people you sell this stuff to. In 2016, the company's president, David Sundman, received the ANA. This is the American Numismatic Association Dealer of the Year Award. And Littleton Coin was honored by the Better Business Bureau Torch Award for Marketplace Ethics. So you know these people are people you can trust and rely on. Whether you're an experienced collector or someone who needs help identifying what you have in your collection, Littleton Coin Company is the place to sell your U.S. coins and currency. The process is incredibly simple. Visit littletoncoin.com/majority to learn more. Or give them a call toll-free 877-857-7850. Tell them the Majority Report sent you. Also, just want to briefly mention, and we will get more to this, but Philip Longman is someone we've wanted to have on for a while. Because, as you know, we've been talking about monopoly power for some time, and certainly starting before the last election. And he wrote a piece about healthcare monopolies in October of 2016, anticipating probably, I don't know, that Hillary Clinton would win the election. And in this piece, he compared and contrasted the two perspectives that Sanders and Clinton had on dealing with healthcare. But he reminds us in that piece that the real issue with healthcare, and single payer will help with this a little bit in some areas, but the real issue is the cost of healthcare in this country. And one of the big drivers of costs of healthcare in this country is monopolies. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Washington Monthly editor and former policy director and managing editor of New America's Open Markets Program, Philip Longman, will be here to tell us about that. You'll recall that the Open Markets Program was just jettisoned from New America's New America Foundation because of a controversy involving funding from Google. Maybe we'll touch on that with him briefly. I'm not sure how psyched he is to talk about it, but we'll see. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Is the sky the limit? What is the apogee? Sky the limit for me. I only mean to love you, for you to notice me. Now I dread how limited I can be. Radiate, radiate away. Leviathans and chimeras, hydras below the sea, they come between me and where I want to be. From this sky I've fallen to suffer and to burn. It is to the sky that I shall return. Radiate,
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Philip Longman. He is a senior editor of Washington Monthly and the policy director and managing editor of the Open Market Institute, formerly with, or I should say the Open Markets Program was formerly with a New America Foundation. Welcome to the program, Philip.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me, Sam.
And, you know, we may circle back when we talk a little bit more about the general issues with monopoly, about what happened over at New America's Foundation and the relationship with the Open Markets Program. We've talked about that quite a bit on this program, and I just want to maybe, as we talk about healthcare, we'll circle back. But your your piece, which was written in almost this time last year, actually, dealt with the competing proposals for, or opened it with, I should say, the competing proposals for fixing our healthcare system by Clinton and Sanders. And so talk about that. I mean, yesterday, Bernie Sanders introduced a single-payer bill. Obviously, we are years away from that bill, maybe even getting a hearing in Congress. But nevertheless, explain to folks why that's not going to solve necessarily all of the cost issues that we have associated with healthcare.
Yeah. Well, I think the subject is more relevant today than it was a year ago, even, not least because so many people, not just Bernie Sanders, but so many people across the spectrum of the Democratic Party have decided that now is the time to salute what we're now calling single-payer health care, by which many people mean many different things. But it's important that we get clear about what exactly we mean and why, although there are many things that are great about what people describe as single-payer health care, it is not sufficient in itself to deal with the problems that we face in our health care system. So just to unpack that a little bit, Dana Milbank has a column out this morning in which the headline is, "The Democrats All Become Socialists." And he's referring to the great groundswell of people signing up for single-payer. But single-payer is not socialized medicine. It's nothing like socialized medicine. In fact, it's closer in its current form to corporate welfare. So here's what I mean, right? What is the Medicare program? What does it do, right? It does not provide health care to anybody. It doesn't have any hospitals, doesn't have any doctors that it employs, right? It provides subsidies to a healthcare provider industry that includes hospitals, includes drug makers, it includes device makers, it includes all kinds of folks, right? But it is not in the business of providing healthcare. We do actually have an example of real socialized medicine in the United States, and that would be your veterans healthcare system, right? Which does have actual hospitals, does employ doctors, and is run by public employees in the public interest. That's not what Medicare does. Medicare, in effect, competes with private health insurance companies, but not with the private insurance, or not with private medical industrial complex, if you will. The problem is that years ago, like back in the 70s, when many folks started to make the crusade on the left for a single-payer healthcare system or a Medicare for all system, right? The healthcare industry in the United States was largely still a cottage industry. Most doctors worked in solo practices. Hospitals were mostly locally owned nonprofit organizations that were quite benign. Today, we're looking at a completely different world in which most communities in America today no longer have anything like real competition between hospitals or between doctors, because we've gone through this huge wave of mergers and acquisitions that has led to the agglomeration of what were once independent doctors and hospitals into giant hospital chains and integrated healthcare systems. And if we're not careful, all we're going to wind up doing is subsidizing that giant Goliath and making it even more politically powerful, and in a way that will prevent us from actually doing anything meaningful in the reform of healthcare delivery.
All right, before we get into
healthcare finance,
before we get into to that danger, I want give us a sense. I mean, I think like intuitively, I think people see that doctors are becoming more associated with hospitals, and that, you know, certainly, you know, I live in New York. I've lived in New England with some pretty big cities and a lot of hospitals, and I felt conscious of the merging between hospitals. When we talk about like the 70s or the 60s or the 50s in terms of hospitals, were there that many more hospitals that were independent? Can you give us a sense of that as a data point? And let me also just say, when you started to raise Dana Milbank's piece, I was a little bit concerned, and it wasn't until I realized it was an example of what was wrong did I feel more comfortable. Where were you going with that? I just have to have to get that off my chest. But so just tell us about, I mean, in terms of the hospitals, like is there a number? Like were there 5,000, 10,000 hospitals, 500 hospitals? Where have we gone to where we've become in terms of like ownership concentration on hospitals?
Yeah. Okay. Well, here's some stats. So basically, according to a study that came out of Harvard 2 years ago, we're now in a world in which 40% of all hospital stays occur in hospitals where there is no competition. It's the only hospital in town. Okay. So that is up dramatically from what it was in the 1950s. I can't tell you exactly what the number would have been, but it's been the preoccupation of the healthcare industry since really the 80s to merge. And it's actually been hastened along by the Affordable Care Act, which in many ways encourages healthcare providers into merging into things called accountable care organizations. We don't really have a coherent policy at the federal level on this question. You know, I like to say that on any given day, if you go over to one side of the mall in Washington, in Washington, right, you've got a building that houses the Department of Health and Human Services, which is every day trying to encourage healthcare providers to merge with each other so that they can integrate their care better and do less fragmented care under the vision of the Affordable Care Act. And on the other side of the mall, there's another federal bureaucracy called the Federal Trade Commission that is routinely suing hospitals for merging. And yet not doing enough of that merging or enough of that suing to prevent most markets in America now from having any effective competition. So these are local monopolies, right? There's not one giant healthcare chain that controls some giant part of the healthcare market, but healthcare itself is local. So when you live in a community where the last two hospitals merged with each other or were bought out by some larger chain, you no longer live in a world where you have choice, or even more to the point where your health insurance company has choice. Your health insurance company, when it comes into town to negotiate prices and to create a network, is basically a price taker because there's only one hospital. There's only one entity from which to buy healthcare. So that entity dictates the price.
Now, in the piece, you suggest that there is some value
in vertical integration, in creating those teams, you know, and I think, I mean, I think there's some data to support that in terms of like medical outcomes. But explain the difference between vertical integration and horizontal integration. And I certainly, I mean, having just had a family member in for pneumonia with other complications, I mean, mm-hmm. I could see what. And I don't know if this came from vertical integration, but there were different teams of doctors who were specialists, and they all seemed to be somewhat coordinated, but they were all under an umbrella. And that, I think, probably, certainly I found comforting and more easy to navigate. But mm-hmm. Delineate for us the difference between vertical integration and horizontal integration, because we'll swing back to this when we talk about solutions on some level.
Well, here's part of the dilemma we face, right? That most people, as they experience the American healthcare system, experience something that's actually not a system. It's very, very fragmented. So we've all had the experience that you go to some doctor and you have to fill out all these forms while you're in the waiting room, even though you just filled out all those forms for some other doctor down the hall last week, but those two doctors don't coordinate with each other. They don't work off a common medical record, right? And so there's all this bouncing around, and it can be quite lethal, right? Because a lot of people don't have their care coordinated by any one doctor, one primary care medical home type doctor. Instead, they bounce around from multiple specialists who treat one body part at a time and don't talk to each other about what prescriptions their drugs they're prescribing, and otherwise coordinate their care. And that's a big reason why American healthcare has become so dangerous. I mean, American healthcare is literally the third leading cause of death in the United States after all cancer and all heart disease, because of the just extraordinary numbers of medical errors and uncoordinated care that goes on. So we really would like to have greater integration of care, right? But if the way we overcome this problem is by creating gigantic monopolies that are unaccountable to the public and are effectively unregulated in their pricing, we've maybe solved one problem partially, but created another one, a really big one. And that's, I'm arguing, is basically the main thrust of where we're going now. That's the main current in healthcare today, right? Is we are moving to these increasingly integrated giant systems, which have the promise of better integrating care and of achieving certain economies of scale, but which, if left unregulated, become predatory. And this, you know, we face the same question in a lot of other realms, right? There's a lot of things, a lot of sectors of the economy where scale is important, right? We don't want to have 15 different electrical power companies covering every part of the city, right? It's more efficient to just have one. But having just one means you have to regulate it as a utility. If you just turn your back on the fact that it's a monopoly, you wind up being eaten. So that's where we are now. And studies that have come out in the last year or so suggest that in communities where the last two remaining hospitals merge, the price increase is about 20%. On top of what exists in more competitive markets. And that's a lot because we don't really have any really competitive markets, right? It's if it's not a monopoly, it's a duopoly. And the amount of formal and informal collusion that it goes on between these institutions is just gigantic. So we have kind of a fork in the road. We either have to say we're going to use antitrust and other mechanisms like it to make sure that we don't have that we always have pretty robust competition in markets, or if we're going to go the other route and say we're going to embrace monopoly, then we need to regulate it. That means regulating prices, just like we would do with an electric utility or telephone utility.
So, okay, so isn't theoretically the part of the dilemma in terms of pricing anyways, that if you do have a duopoly or a monopoly in a local area where there's it's serviced by an insurer, a private insurer, that the private insurer comes in there and has no negotiation power because there's only one provider essentially that they're negotiating with. But in the event that you have a single payer, doesn't the hospital then have a problem too? Because there's only one buyer of their services, and that is, let's say, Medicare, expanded Medicare. So that returns, I mean, that's one of the theories behind why you would get some cost control out of Medicare, right? Is it's we're the only buyer. So you can raise your prices all you want, and you're right, you may be the only supplier, but I got news for you. Nobody's going to be able to come in and buy your services because we're the buyer. Right. How much of that will help, and why is that not enough?
Okay. Well, again, let's go back to the 70s when people first started thinking about this, right? And they pointed to places like Canada, and they said, well, in Canada, they have a single-payer system. Actually, they didn't have a single-payer system. They had 12 different provinces that purchased health care. It was government-purchased health care versus a highly fragmented, deconcentrated health care industry, mostly composed of solo practice doctors. So in that case, the government did have a great deal of market power over these providers and did exercise great power in restraining their prices. The doctors responded in Canada by forming a union, in other words, a kind of monopoly of their own, right? But nonetheless, right, it was basically a very powerful government player coming into the market versus a very fragmented healthcare system, right? Today, what we're looking at in most markets under a Medicare for all type treatment, if that's all it is single payer meets single provider. And what happens then? I mean, let's make this like really concrete, right? Let's imagine we're in Cleveland, and in Cleveland, there's a single institution called the Cleveland Clinic, and it has 80% market share and growing, right, in that market. Medicare needs to make sure that people that live in Cleveland can use their Medicare insurance. So it has to come to some kind of accommodation with the Cleveland Clinic, because if people in Cleveland can't use their Medicare to go to the Cleveland Clinic, they don't have any place else to go. So what's the politics of that going to look like, right? We're going to have the Cleveland Clinic out there running commercials and having their lobbyists spread the message that these evil people in Washington are standing in the way of you being able to come and get the very fine services of the Cleveland Clinic. And you should write your congressman, you should get mad and throw the rascals out because they're not giving the Cleveland Clinic what the Cleveland Clinic wants. And that's how it would play out. It already plays out that way. But not at the scale that we would be talking about in the future. So, again, it's single provider.
Fair enough. Yeah. However, right, I mean, you're talking about the congressperson from Cleveland, and you're talking about perhaps some pressure on those senators. I mean, but that's the point of why you get that value of it being a national buyer. But and so... I mean, I would think that on some level would mitigate it, But I mean, I get your drift here on some level is that in a single payer will increase the market power, but as long as you have a single provider or increasingly concentrated provider, their political power grows.
Yeah. And they have, the Cleveland Clinic has a great brand, right? People think that the Cleveland Clinic provides really great health care. They have a really aggressive public relations effort that is highly effective. Most people have heard of the Cleveland Clinic, just have the received idea that that's a really top-notch organization. So they're going to be really upset to hear that their government is not allowing them to go to the Cleveland Clinic. That's the basic dynamic, right? Another way to think of this is where else do we find this in the federal government, right? We find this in defense contracting, right? We have a single payer defense department, right? All of the weapon systems purchased in the United States are purchased by a single, military grade weapon systems are purchased by a single buyer, right? Single payer called the Department of Defense. But it turns out that there's been more and more merging of defense contractors to the point that if you want to build an aircraft carrier, say, there's only one shipyard left in the United States that will build one for you. So when you go to build an aircraft carrier, you have to go to that shipyard and they tell you how much it costs. Basically the same dynamic.
So, okay. So with that reality, I am announcing my candidacy for 2020. I win because I just catch fire. What tools already exist and how should I use them in regards to this problem? And what tools would I look to Congress to pass?
Mm-hmm. I think we need, and we have all the, in current law, we have all those policy levers we need. We don't really need a whole lot of new legislation, if any. But you want to use existing antitrust law to ensure that in every market, every major metropolitan area, right, there's at least two, maybe three independent competing health, integrated healthcare systems, right? We kind of did that with car makers back in the 50s, right? We understood that there was a certain economies of scale to making cars. It didn't make sense to have 70 different car makers in the United States, but it didn't make sense to have one either. So federal competition policy kind of engineered things that throughout the 50s, 60s, and 70s, there would be three to four major automakers, which was kind of the sweet spot. It left you with economies of scale, possibilities for integration, but didn't leave any of them in a monopoly position. So do the same kind of thing with hospitals.
So but how does that work from a local standpoint? Like how, okay. So, I mean, that's one thing to say, like we've got national car companies, but how do you make sure you go into Cleveland? And what do you say that, you do this by saying like, okay, if you are a hospital corporation that owns more than, let's say, 39% or 25% of the services in any one locality, you have to sell this off? Is that basically it?
Yeah. And and throughout American history, we've done things. We used to do things like that with chain stores, right? You said, you can't, we used to say the old Atlantic and Pacific grocery store, right? You can't control more than 40% of the groceries in any county in America, right? That was to ensure competition.
We theoretically do that with owner-operated television stations, although Sinclair Media has just found a little bit of a loophole. Yeah. They've been giving a gift.
That's the same
concept. And so theoretically, what would happen? So we say this. I announced this. We have the statutory authority to do it through the Federal Trade Commission, I guess. And mm-hmm. I say, okay, you got 4 years. To work this out, 3 years. I don't know mm-hmm. how long it will take. And and then hospital corporations will end up with like three or four major hospital corporations or maybe three or four regional you know, per region, I guess, that might be big hospitals that will operate 3 or 4 or 5 or 10 different facilities, and these companies will split it up there. Is that like what, like when this well, is it, fixed, it, yeah. what it do might, you envision?
All healthcare delivery, at least, is local. So it might turn out that you had big national chains, but in any given market, they wouldn't have more than 20% market share, right? You would just prevent that. And by the way, the reason to do this is not just to encourage price competition among providers, although there'd be some of that. I mean, that's an important consideration, right? But it's also to restrain the political power of any one of these providers, right? And this is an ancient trade-off that in American politics that current generations have forgotten about. But in the last progressive era, people had furious debates about the difference between busting up trusts and monopolies versus letting big trusts and monopolies operate but regulating them, right? And so you had people like Teddy Roosevelt towards the end of his career would say, well, actually, monopolies can be good, right? Because monopolies have all these economies of scale and they can deliver cheaper prices many times. So let's embrace monopolies, but have this really big government regulatory system to make sure that they behave themselves. And then you had other people like Woodrow Wilson and Louis Brandeis saying, you know, nothing could be more naive than that thought. The idea that once you allow these giants to achieve huge scale, that they won't take over the government too. Right? And I think and I think most progressives, if they examine the way they look at the world, will recognize the essential truth of the proposition that over right. time, you know, giant corporations come to monopolize not just markets, but politics itself. And so we need to make sure that we have locally owned, locally controlled small scale providers of healthcare. Right.
So what is the mechanism for that? So, I mean, I can say in any locality, you cannot control more than, let's just say, 25% of the medical services. That's still a recipe for, you know, like a clear channel of medicine, essentially, right? Where they have a local affiliates in every place in the country, and then you've got a very powerful political entity. They may own only 25% of the country's medical system, but it would be the country's, as opposed to, you know, 80% in Cleveland, let's say. So how do you, can you then say, like, and you can only own 25% in any given locality, and in terms of nationally, you can't control more than, let's say, 10%.
Right. Well, you know, there's trade-offs in that question. I don't pretend to know the definitive one answer to that, right? You might decide that by limiting the market power of the provider in any given location, that would be enough to get the kind of economic and political competition that we need, or you might decide, you know, it's really convenient to have healthcare providers that have a national scale, so that when I move from Washington to Phoenix, you know, I can stay with the same integrated healthcare system. That that makes for better medicine. It's a better consumer experience. So it's trade-offs, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I think I'm much less afraid of one company having a national presence, but remaining competitive in every given market, versus individual markets that just get monopolized, right?
Because the balancing act there is. You're going to deal with the amassing of political power, but because they won't have pricing power in the same way on a local basis, that's going to inhibit their political power as well on some level.
Yeah. So local consumers of healthcare and local politicians will have the power to say no, right? Because they won't, you know, if we can't come to an accommodation with Cleveland Clinic, on what the right price is under their Medicare contract, well, we can send people over to this other hospital system, right? And people will be happy to go because that one's up and ready and eager to please, right? So that's the basic vision. We have to remember here too that we're talking about, you asked earlier about vertical integration, right? Vertical integration refers to people monopolizing all different elements of a supply chain, right? So in healthcare, what that means is you've got a single entity that owns the doctors, right? Literally employs the doctors, a single entity that literally controls all the labs in town, right? And literally controls the hospital too. And now increasingly, literally controls insurance. So if you live in Pittsburgh, for example, we have this entity that's called the Pittsburgh Academic Medical Center that sounds benign, but actually has a monopolization, not just in the provision of all forms of healthcare, including testing, but in the financing of healthcare too. So that's what we're up against. And of course, there's all kinds of monopolization in other forms of healthcare, right? Like insurance companies themselves are merging, but also, and more to the point, you know, drug companies are merging, and that gives them more pricing power and would give them more pricing power under some single payer system, right?
All of which, I guess, is, you know, and so none of what we've talked about cannot be done with laws already on the books. Is that right?
No, I think all of it can be done. We have a robust tradition in the United States of antitrust, and we have all kinds of laws on the books dating back to the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890 and the Clayton Act of 1914 and all kinds of other legislation on the books that gives federal regulators the power to do these kind of things. They did these kind of things for most of the 20th century, an era in which the United States emerges in industrial policy and built a gigantic, broad, prosperous middle class, right? And then we stopped doing them sometime in the late 70s, 80s. And that's basically it. It's a matter of prosecutorial discretion, mostly. We've got some case law now that's built up that some people argue makes it more difficult to do it. We might have to pass some laws here and there, but the basic difference is, you know, what are the criteria you use to decide what's a monopoly, right? Under current practice, right, prosecutors basically won't bring a case unless they can show overt collusion, right, between two entities and or price gouging. So if there's, in the absence of price gouging, in the absence of collusion, any monopoly is basically left alone. That's why we have something like Amazon, right?
Right.
But it doesn't have to be that way. That's prosecutorial discretion. Right,
and we should say that, and we've certainly spoken to both folks like Kay Sabeel Rahman and Barry Lynn and Matt Stoller over the past year or so. This mm-hmm. is largely a function of a new Reagan era Robert Bork led mm-hmm. revision of how we look at monopolies as being problematic, and deeming that monopolies are only problematic based upon what kind of price they can deliver on a product, with ignoring all of the other societal implications, like their political power, like long-term, pricing. You know, at yep. one point, and when Amazon owns everything, they're going to say, hey, guess what?
That's right.
Free shipping? Not so much. And, yeah. you know, the cheaper stuff? Not so much anymore. And what are you going to do? You know, there's not going to be anybody left. All right. Well, with all that said, another example of that is the massive power. They say Amazon gets something like 80 cents of every dollar online. The only other behemoth that can rival Amazon in its control of a certain sector of what happens online is, of course, Google. And just briefly from your perspective, because there's a lot of controversy, and I understand, you know, within the context of think tanks, there's all sorts of different dynamics that are in play, including personalities and whatnot. But the bottom line is, open markets, the program that is now spun off, you're now a policy director and managing editor of an open market institute as opposed to an open markets program at a at a New America think tank. How does what happened there shine some light on this dynamic of the power of monopolies, even though it had nothing to do with the pricing of, you know, searching online, let's say?
Mm-hmm. Well, New America was a think tank, is a think tank. I've been there since 1999 when it started. And as a think tank, it needs to raise money. And over time, it felt the need to raise money from corporate sponsors and from various very high net worth individuals, including, as it turned out, Eric Schmidt, who was the chairman of Google, who became the chairman of New America for many, many years, and who gave vast amounts of money to New America. Now, there are many things I like about Eric Schmidt. I spent a fair amount of time with Eric Schmidt. I will attest to his character. But when you have an institution that is that beholden to an entity like Google that's getting more and more powerful in the world, it becomes very difficult to speak freely about Google's role in the monopolization of the American economy. So basically, that was a train wreck that was kind of predictable, and it happened. And so we are no longer with New America, but we have other sources of funding that are not so directly involving conflicts of interest. And so the work continues. But it's a big problem. It gets to, I guess, your larger question here. It gets to this point about why do we do antitrust? Since the 70s, the idea is we only do it to enhance consumer welfare, as if all any of us are is consumers, and as if our welfare is completely defined by cheap prices. Well, guess what? We're not just all consumers. We're citizens too, right? And we're also producers, right? Sellers of labor, sellers of things, right? And so antitrust shouldn't have this focus merely on consumers. It should have a focus on citizens and on the overall political and economic health of society, right? And what we're seeing now in the collision between Google and New America illustrates it. What we're seeing now is that this amass of economic power eventually seeps in to all segments of society and corrupts them subtly, right? It's corrupting the world of Washington Policy Institute's think tanks, because no think tanks left in D.C. that isn't beholden in some way to these giant entities, right? It increasingly has monopolized academia, right, where Google is sponsoring research all over the place at a time when other entities are becoming relatively smaller. The federal government is retreating from its support of research. So academic institutions increasingly bend their research to fit the Google line. And Google doesn't necessarily have to tell scholars that they have to come to a certain conclusion, but over time, there's just a built-in bias that's going to make certain subjects not talked about and others talked about. And so that's part of the reason why antitrust is about the health of society as a whole, not just of the economy.
Philip Longman, Policy Director, Managing Editor of the Open Market Institute. Where can people get more information if they want to get more information on Open Market Institute?
Well, I would tell you to Google Open Market Institute, but I'm not sure what will happen.
I just tried, and it took me to the Competitive Enterprise Institute.
You're kidding, really?
Yeah.
Well, we'd have to work on that. We're working really hard. We've only been doing up and running for a couple of days, right? But
I'll tell you what. You email me, not through Gmail, and tell us, and we will announce it on this program. Philip Longman, yes. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam. It's been a pleasure. Take care.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program, wherein we will really have some fun today. And I mean it. We've got folks who are Steve King, who's so upset about the fact that maybe his wall is not going to be built.
We're
going to
revel in conservative tears.
There's going to be a lot of cleansing ourselves with the tears of conservatives this afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Also, going to hear from Cory Booker, put on the hotspot about his big pharma interests and how he can reconcile that with Medicare for All support. And then remember that Alex Jones acolyte who got owned by
dunked on, they're saying.
Dunked on?
That's the new owned.
Got dunked on by that 12-year-old girl. And you know, make sure you have the original too, because they are a little shifty in the way that they replay that. You know what I mean? So they can justify
some
this
music
thing.
Under it.
And then the heartwarming story of a rags to riches story involving a Scottish actress. I think she's Scottish, who got into some trouble with her Instagram post, and then that led to some trouble for both her and her husband. And now I think this guy, I think Steve Mnuchin, among other things, is in the doghouse. Because, guys, look, you can't try and pass off the cubic zirconia as an engagement ring. And I love the thing like, oh, sweetheart, I'm going to take you on a great honeymoon. I'm going to see if I can get the government to pay for it. All that and more, ladies and gentlemen, on the fun half today. And don't forget, you can support this program by becoming a member. Best part about being a member, we give you bonus material. No, wait a sec. Let me back up. The best part about being a member, you are supporting the free show. That's the best part about it. And then the second best part about it is you get more content. All sorts of different things you can listen to at any given time. It gives you a world of choice. The third best thing about it is you don't have to hear the commercials. So when members hear my voice right now, they're going like, commercials? What commercials? I've never heard a commercial. You have commercials? Yeah, occasionally we have commercials. You don't have to listen to those. So it's a great deal. Go to jointhemajorityreport.com and become a member today. It is literally pennies a day. I mean, a lot of pennies. More pennies than you would carry around, but
it's technically pennies a day to take a government jet to your honeymoon.
It's true. That's true. But that would be more pennies than you could even have in your house. This is more like the type of pennies where you'd be like, I got to empty these out at the end of the day. I can't keep walking around with this many pennies. But when you talk about quarters, it's more quarters. It's less quarters than you could carry in your pocket. You wouldn't even feel a thing. Carried those in quarters. So join themajorityreport.com. And of course, if you buy your stuff through Amazon, many of you do, the least you can do is to give us a kickback at majorityreportkickback.com. But, and granted, it's Walmart, but online. Be nice to have a duopoly as opposed to a monopoly. Jet.com. We also have a link for Jet.com at MajorityReportKickback.com. And it's a great service. I like Jet quite a bit, actually. Also, JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Fair trade. Coffee. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. See you in the fun half.
She said, no, 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 no. Things are looking bad. She said, no, no, no.